This is Bob Holmes from SUS, and you're listening to episode 30 of Ambient Country, where we explore the wide landscape of instrumental music in the genres of new folk, Americana, jazz, ambient, electronic, soundscapes, and cosmic psychedelia. Well, folks, guess who's back again? It's my old friend Hayden Pettigo. You know, Hayden helped co-host one of my first episodes a couple of years ago, so I have him to thank in no small part for helping me get this whole thing started in the first place. And because I was able to get Hayden back here, I wanted to do something a little different this time. If you follow Hayden on any of his social media platforms, you know he does things a little different, and a little better than just about anyone else. One of his latest posts was about the guitar records that inspired him in his youth, so I thought, hey, this would be a great listening experience. So I asked Hayden to come on the show and give us a portrait of an artist as a young man in 10 records or less. He said yes, and I'm very excited about it. But before we get started, let's listen to the title track of his latest release on Mexican Summer Records called The Happiest Times I Ever Ignored. So Hayden, welcome back to Ambient Country.
Thanks, Bob. Glad to be here. Thanks for talking with me again.
Oh my goodness, it's so, you know, folks at home, I wish you could see the smiling face I'm looking at today, because whenever I see Hayden, his smile makes me smile. Just makes me feel really good.
I appreciate that.
Yeah, I mean, I saw you perform last summer in New York, but man, so much has happened since the last time that you were on the podcast. You had the release of a new record, and I already talked about that a little bit. The Happiest Times I Ever Ignored on Mexican Summer Records. And then you toured with just about everybody. And now you're just getting ready to do your last show in LA promoting this album. As I said, it's been quite a year. This has to be better than a day job. Tell me about that. It's got to be better.
Yeah, definitely better than a day job. I mean, you know, I did the banking thing for a long time. Music was not something I ever thought I would be doing as a full-time thing. And it just kind of came out of nowhere in my life. But Mexican Summer was definitely the catalyst for a lot of it, just because they believed in me and my record, Letting Go, when I sent it to them. And that was kind of the game changing moment. And then so much has changed since then. And I feel like I'm finally able to make the music I always wanted to make. A lot with my music has changed in the past 3 or 4 years.
Yeah, I mean, and it might be a little bit presumptuous of me to say, but it looks like your music has finally gotten around to where you wanted it to be all along.
Yeah.
You took everything that sort of built you as an artist and finally put the building blocks all together in an amazingly unique way that is what I now call the Hayden Pettigo sound.
Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate that. And it's weird that it feels like it took me 10 years to figure out, to fine tune what my sound was. Because even listening back to my older records now, it's weird how much my guitar playing has changed, how the production has changed. My records used to be a lot more chaotic and kind of messy in a lot of ways. And the past two albums were the first time I really, really took it serious. The music became a lot more important to me in a way I had never experienced when I was younger.
Yeah, they are more controlled. They're more original. And as I hope that this episode of the podcast is going to show, your new music shows off your influences without trading on those influences or copying them. You've distilled them into something completely unique that I'm in complete awe of. So once again, congratulations on that.
Thank you so much, Bob. I really appreciate that.
Yeah. Let's talk about this playlist, because, you know, it started out, and this whole idea came about because of an Instagram post you put together about the five records that really got you started, that really influenced you there. And this writing that you did about these five albums is like, wow, okay. If this just had a soundtrack, it would be the perfect thing. So, hey, I'm no dummy. Here we are today. And we're kind of going to reiterate that and expand on it and add some of that music. You want to just sort of give us a bit of an idea of your criteria that you used in putting these tracks together?
Yeah, the criteria for these 10 songs was I wanted to kind of trace the earliest guitar influences for me, and not super early, because I mean, if I go so far back, it's going to be things like Stevie Ray Vaughan or Eric Clapton when I'm 11 years old. But I was starting with the years in my teen years where I felt like I was discovering who I was as a musician. So I pinned down my most formative influences on guitar from those teenage years.
When you're saying teenage, you're talking about like early high school and on, kind of like that.
13 to 17.
Yeah.
That's the window I chose. So it's the influences from 13 years old up to 17 years old.
Wow. I just love it. That's amazing. And I'll probably bring this up a few times over the course of the podcast. Some of this music is not the normal music that a 13 to 17-year-old would be listening to. So you got to cue me in on how you found this music, you know.
Yes, definitely. I tried to trace it out in an interesting way, and there's some good stories with these songs, I think.
You know, we're going to start with a track that's one of the more recent tracks, and it's from 2013 from an artist who goes by the moniker of DBH, and the track is called Fix. And this is one of the tracks in your playlist, an artist that I'd never heard of before, but I started doing a deep dive on DBH, and he's done some amazing stuff.
Yeah, this is definitely one of the later influences on the playlist, because I found that record right after I graduated high school. So when I said 13 through 17, I think this is the only one that would be 18 years old. So this is the only one that's a later influence. But I found this record when I was back when I was on Facebook. It was like a random discovery that someone had made a post about this record, because I believe DBH is a UK guy, a UK guitar player. And I was blown away by that record, and still to this day, every single record DBH, because I think his name is Dan Bridgewood Hill. His name, and he goes by DBH. But he's very under the radar, low key guitar player, and one of the best. He hasn't put out much, and that song Fix is still to this day one of my absolute favorite instrumental guitar pieces by anyone ever. And he's a relatively unknown player, but yeah, had a huge influence on me with the melodic style of playing. It definitely was one of the first post-Fahey modern influences that inspired my picking and how I approach melody. It's an insanely, insanely melodic piece, great technique. Honestly, has a little bit more of an influence on the mid. It sounds almost like Midwest emo American football style picking and melodic style that at the time I had never heard of American football or music like that. But I can see the connection now. Highly recommended. Any of the DBH albums are good. Every single one of them is good. If you play guitar, you're into finger picking guitar music, listen to DBH, turn them on to other people, because he's too underrated.
Cool. All right. So we're going to give a listen to the track Fix by DBH. Thank you. And that was Will Ackerman and his track and song from the 2003 album, Returning. Hayden, I said this to you before we started the interview today, but I can still remember clear as day. You dropped me a text or an email or something and asked me if I would give a listen to your new album. I said, well, of course. I can't wait to hear what this is going to be like. And I remember that there seemed to be a little bit of trepidation in your attitude, like, you know, just be prepared for something a little different here. I might be, you know, I'm treading on some sacred ground, whether it's ECM or Windham Hill. So it's it maybe is not what you're going to expect from me from the last record. And I was like, whoa, this is going to be interesting. And I got the links in the email. And lo and behold, you were absolutely right, except for the fact that I loved it from the first note. I remember that I think the first thing I heard was Elsewhere, and I was like, oh, my God, Hayden, this is going to be amazing. People are just going to go wild for this. And you know, so I was blown away from the first listen. And, you know, I've had a lot of co-hosts on my show since then, and everyone, not everyone, but a lot of people have talked about you and your style and this album, and it's shown up in a lot of playlists from a lot of other artists. So I know you've made a huge dent with fans, but with other artists as well, it's really really turned their heads around. And so, you know, what's that been like to just capture the hearts and minds of so many people with one record out there?
It's been pretty amazing, and it's exciting to put out an album where you feel like it's your strongest work. Up until that point, where I believe in it, and I'm like, you know, I really am proud of what the songs I wrote. I definitely set out to be a better guitar player on that album. So when people tell me they like it, especially other artists and guitar players, it means a lot to me, especially with people whose music I love and I'm inspired by. So it's been incredible to just have people be receptive to something that was very personal to me, and I put a lot of love, care, and a lot of time into, because so much time went into that album. Like, it was a true labor of love, a lot of work. But I'm just so happy people have enjoyed this record.
I know a lot of time went into the preparation of it, because it's not easy music to play. But I do remember you telling me that basically you went into the studio, and a lot of these are just first or second takes, full run-throughs. You pretty much recorded all the basic tracks in like a day or two or something like that. Is that what you said?
Yeah, all of the guitar parts were done. Like, all of the core tracks, the acoustic guitar pieces, were recorded on the first day.
Wow.
I got that from Leo Kottke, because the 6 and 12 string guitar album, he did all of that in 4 hours, that entire record.
Yeah.
He just went into the studio, they set up the mic, he played every single song he had written, and that was it. So I had this idea that was like, I need to be able to play these songs really, really, really well before I step into the studio, because I kind of have a rule in myself that I don't do more than 3 takes in a day on a song. So if I start playing a song and I play it and screw up, restart, play it and screw up, restart, play it and screw up, I don't let myself attempt it again that day. It's like a 3 strikes and you're out rule, where if I'm screwing up after 3 takes, I can't do that one again until the next day. So I have to practice them enough where I shouldn't have to do 3 takes. I want to be able to knock every song out on the guitar within 2 takes. And that just takes a lot of practicing and getting comfortable with it.
Well, it shows. I just wanted to go back to the last artist that we played in the last track, And Song by Will Ackerman. I'm assuming that there is a lot of Will Ackerman influence in your music. And if nothing else, the production technique, the clean crystalline sounds, the open air. I hear the Will Ackerman sound in the silence between your notes, I think is the best way that I can put it, that open air feel.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Will Ackerman's influence on my playing is really, really really intense. I mean, the thing I look to for Will Ackerman is the melody, because he's very, very melodic, and the touch. He has a very, very specific touch where he really is not a crazy technical player. I've always said, if you compare him to his cousin Alex Degrassi, if you compare their playing to each other, Alex is a far more advanced player technique-wise. But my hot take is Will Ackerman is the far superior writer out of the two of them. And I actually think he has the better touch. No offense to Alex Degrassi, I love his playing. But Will Ackerman, I think a lot of people kind of sleep on him a little bit because they don't view his playing as technical, but I'm like, that's not the key to Will Ackerman. It's his touch and it's his melodies. And everything he plays is just perfect. It sounds exactly the way it needs to be. And whenever I listen to Will Ackerman, I think to myself, like, this is how the guitar should be played. This is the ideal guitar music. Because the second I listen to instrumental guitar music where it gets, like, I don't know, too technical or too shreddy, it's just my brain just deletes it. I'm like, I can't listen to this. No response for me. But Will Ackerman, to me, I always get a very emotional response from his music. And the one I chose on this playlist is actually the version of Anne's song from Returning, which that album's interesting in his catalog, because Returning is an album of re-recordings of his Windham Hill stuff from the late 70s, early 80s. It's all old songs. And I like the Returning version better just because it's like that hyper crystal clear digital early 2000s sound, where some of the older Windham Hill, Will Ackerman records sound good, but they have a little bit of tape hiss on them that... In his case, I'm not huge on the tape hiss on the original versions.
Yeah.
So I prefer the Returning version of Anne's song a lot more.
So, you know, I'm going to keep returning to this idea of the portrait of an artist as a young man. Let's be honest. High school kids usually don't sit around listening to Windham Hill records, not even back in the 90s. How did you find this? And when you were listening to it, did you have a group of friends or comrades who were like, yeah, let's go back to Hayden's place after school and listen to a Windham Hill record?
No, I mean, I was homeschooled. My dad was a pastor and I was homeschooled the entire way. Like, I went to kindergarten and my parents pulled me out of school in kindergarten, and then I was homeschooled the rest of the way. So I lived out in the country. My dad was a pastor. So I was incredibly isolated. I didn't have friends in middle school or high school at all because I wasn't around other kids. Uh-huh. I wasn't in public school. I lived out in the country and wasn't going anywhere. So literally I didn't have friends till I was 17. So during my teen years, I was homeschooled completely by myself, and I would go to the library all the time with my mom. And that's back when at the library you could rent CDs. And the Amarillo Downtown Public Library had a massive, massive CD collection. That's sad it's not there anymore. They got rid of all the CDs. But that is kind of where a lot of this begins for me. Because, I mean, the earliest things like Ry Cooder and all that, which we'll get to later, that's all from the Amarillo Public Library renting CDs. So when I was finding this stuff, it started at the library and then eventually went onto the internet when I was around 15, I really started getting on the internet and finding quite a bit of stuff. But no, I didn't have any music scene or friends or anyone to share this with. This was just all in the bedroom of my parents' house by myself.
Wow. And so, you know, we're going to go on to this next track here. Are you telling me that you could go to the Amarillo Public Library and get a disc of Popo Vuh? And because that's the next track up is Morgan Gruß from the 1974 album, and please pardon the enunciation, Eisenjager and Steinbenjager. I don't know.
You probably.
I'm not going to get a job with the UN. I'll tell you that. So. So, I mean, this is one of my this album that this came from is one of my all-time inspirations. It came out in 74, just as I was getting out of high school. And I had been turned on to Kraftwerk. I thought that that's what krautrock was all about, and I was so completely wrong. You know, I had no idea about bands like Popo Vuh and Neu and Can and all of that other stuff. So this was kind of my... after Kraftwerk, I would say that Popol Vuh was kind of my starter drug in this area.
Yeah. And that's one that I did not find that through the library on CD. The Amarillo Library, the furthest out they would go is they would have like Frank Zappa, John Cage, maybe some King Crimson, things like that. But it once you started to get to things like Captain Beefheart, you know, downward, you weren't finding stuff like that. And that's where the internet came into play for me. And that's how I started finding these, because there was a couple of websites I frequented a lot from the ages of 14 to 18. There was a website, Prog Rock Archives, which was an incredible, incredible website. There was a blog called Mutant Sounds Blogspot that you could find the craziest stuff. John Fahey bootlegs, Starving Gristle live recordings, the albums by the Red Crayola, anything that was outsider music, Mutant Sounds would post about, which was like free downloads because it was just like a blog. And that's where a lot of my taste really started to be formed. The timeline, it's like trying to piece together this timeline of how my music happened. I found Ry Cooder before John Fahey. So I started to learn how to play slide because I couldn't shred on my left hand. I couldn't do fast guitar playing, so...
Were you aware of the, with Ry Cooder, were you aware of the movies as well, or it all just came through recorded CDs and things like that?
Recorded CDs was the first, because, I mean, the self-titled Ry Cooder album was the first one I found. And that's when I started to learn to play slide guitar. And that's before Leo Kottke, John Fahey, Ry Cooder was first. So I discovered his music, started to play slide. And then, you know, discovering CDs, prog rock specific, because, I mean, yes, Genesis, King Crimson, Emerson, Lake and Palmer, all of that stuff came into play. But I can trace how it went weirder and weirder and weirder. So you start with Ry Cooder, then I found John Fahey, then I found things like Genesis, yes, King Crimson, then you find Tangerine Dream, then you find Faust, then you find Throbbing Gristle, then you find, you know, deeper and deeper and deeper into strange music. So by the time I was 17, my influences had all come together into, you know, noise and experimental textures mixed with the slide playing and finger picking that I found through the CDs of Ry Cooder, John Fahey, and Leo Kottke. But the Popol Vuh thing, that comes through the internet when I started diving into the whole krautrock genre universe. And I started off with things like Can and Noy, then Faust came in, and I really liked Faust because Faust was really, they were gnarlier,
yeah, they
sillier.
Yeah, definitely the gnarliest of all, yeah.
Yeah, more screwed up. Their music was very, very screwed up. And then Popol Vuh came in, and they felt so disconnected from the idea of krautrock. I mean, it was very ambient, new agey music. I was really obsessed with the guitar playing throughout their music. I chose that track, this track specifically, because the acoustic guitar probably has the most in common with how I play guitar now, especially on a 12 string or something like that. But multiple of their albums were massively inspirational for me. I'm gonna butcher his name, but their guitarist later, his name is like Danny, I don't know how to pronounce it.
And don't leave it up to me. I'll butcher it. I just finished a book on krautrock, so, and I couldn't pronounce any of the names. So,
well, their guitar player named Daniel. I'm not going to say his last name because I'm going to mispronounce it. But Daniel, Danny, that guitar player, Popol Vuh, is my favorite guitar player. But he's interesting because he was the drummer for Popol Vuh for the first half. And then their guitar player quit and they just asked him, hey, can you take over guitar duties too? And it's wild that the drummer just picks up the guitar too. And he is one of the greatest guitar players ever, in my opinion. And I just love that when you read the history, he was just asking the drummer, hey, can you pick up the slack and just take over guitar duties as well? And wow, that's what he sounds like.
Yeah, this record in particular, in that same period of time, some of the Jerry Garcia or Grateful Dead stuff, it sounds very similar as well, some of the guitar playing.
It's funny because you talked about Popol Vuh, the similarities between, you said, the Grateful Dead.
Yeah.
And it's funny because there was, I even had to look it up, 4 years ago, there was this Chevy Trailblazer commercial that uses a Popol Vuh song. That's really, really crazy. I think the song it uses is I can't say the original name, but Angel of the Present, and then a bit of Heart of Glass. But one of the sections they use is, it's Popol Vuh, and it's nearly identical to the Grateful Dead's lead in China Cat Sunflower.
Yeah.
And it's weird that I'm like, whoa, it's weird that Popol Vuh accidentally ripped off the Grateful Dead, because I think that came out, that track came out well after the Grateful Dead put out China Cat Sunflower. But it's weird to hear Popol Vuh in a Chevy Trailblazer commercial.
Yeah,
but John Fahey also, John Fahey had a song in a Dodge commercial around 2012 or 13, which is really weird. It's from the Yellow Princess album, and it's in a Dodge commercial.
Well, may we all get car commercials. I would see a Hayden Pettigo song in a truck commercial in a heartbeat. So, and I would applaud it.
I mean, I would take it. Yeah. Waiting for him to call me.
Yeah, well, maybe somebody will be listening to this podcast. So let's take a listen to Morgengruß from Popol Vuh. Thank you. And now we are going to go down to a deep, dark hole of Genesis love. So just be prepared. It's the one thing that has bound you forever to me is the fact that that you're an early Genesis lover. So
yes. I mean, Genesis is probably my most important influence, even over Fahey, I can say for sure. Over Fahey, Genesis is the number one most important. The reason why is Genesis, I think I got a CD of Nursery Crime when I was 13 or 14 is when I bought the CD of that. And that came through the library because I rented a book at the library that was like a history of music book. And there was like a chapter that talked about Genesis and it talked about them being a prog rock band. And at the time at 13, I knew Phil Collins doing the Tarzan soundtrack for Disney.
Oh,
and I thought Genesis was like a 80s pop band. I didn't know about the prog rock stuff. So I got Nursery Crime and Steve Hackett's playing on that. It was insane. Like the Return of the Giant Hog lead where he's doing the two hand tapping stuff. And the Mellotrons are really haunted on it. It's really beautiful. It's the first album with Phil Collins. But Genesis, to me, still to this day, I think Genesis is the ultimate prog rock band. And this has come from someone who loves King Crimson. I love Yes. There's so many bands I love, but Genesis, to me, is the number one. They have no comparison. Those albums were truly, truly life-changing for me. I mean, I still listen to it. I've never stopped listening to them. That's the thing, is like my feelings towards Genesis have never, ever, ever changed.
But does your listening pattern stop at like A Lamb Lies Down on Broadway, or do you even listen to stuff after that?
I love Trick of the Tail. I love Wind and the Wuthering. I've even recently been revisiting, or not even revisiting, listening to Then There Were Three, which is kind of an odd album.
Yeah, that was one right after Steve Hackett left, right?
Yes, and there's some duds on that record, but there's some true phenomenal songs on that album. And I don't mind later Genesis, but things like Duke and things like that has never clicked for me. The prog rock years are their best. But I mean, the two records I listen to the most of them is Lamb Lies Down on Broadway and Trick of the Tail. Those are the two I listen to the most of Genesis catalog. I think Lamb Lies Down on Broadway is such a dark, depressing album. It's very, very downer.
All of that was a preamble to the fact that we just listened to Anthony Phillips in his track Trigana Afternoons from an album that he put out called Private Parts and Pieces 1-5, which I'm pretty sure is a collection of work over a long period of time. But he was only with Genesis for a couple albums, and then, but he still continued to make music, so it's pretty amazing.
Yeah, Anthony Phillips is a really, really heavy influence on my playing. Because, of course, it's a continuation on Genesis because his playing inspired Genesis after he left. It's kind of weird. The groundwork he did for Genesis went far beyond his time in Genesis because he quit in 1970 or early 71 because he struggled with stage fright and he was having trouble performing. So he had to quit Genesis. But if you listen to, there's an early demo that Anthony Phillips did that I believe it's called like Song C or something. I have to look up, or no, it's called F Sharp, I think. And it's a demo he made of the song The Musical Box.
Uh-huh.
And it's the whole piece. It's all instrumental and he wrote the whole thing. And it's interesting to hear how he laid the groundwork for Genesis. And I mean, if you listen to an album like Trick of the Tail, which is their return to kind of the English folky pastoral 12-string picking sounds, that's all Anthony Phillips. I mean, even the fact that Anthony Phillips' first solo album, The Geese and the Ghosts, the fact that Phil Collins sings on that record, it shows the influence Anthony had that way, way years after he left Genesis, he has former members of Genesis on his own record singing. But his playing is really unique because my song Carthage on Letting Go is my attempt of writing an Anthony Phillips piece.
Yeah.
Right. Very, very inspired by him.
Great. Cool. Well, so we're going to just jump ahead a little bit now to a more modern artist. So that I'm assuming that this artist probably came later in your education. And that artist is Ben Harper. And the song we're going to play is number 3 from the 1997 album, The Will to Live. So tell me how Ben Harper fits into the overall picture here.
So this is a weird one. This is actually one of the earliest influences on this whole list.
Oh, wow. That's, yeah. Yeah.
I honestly, I'm not a huge fan of Ben Harper's music. This actually came, this is pre-John Fahey, pre-Leo Kottke. Honestly, this might be the earliest finger-picking guitar influence I have on this entire list. This Ben Harper album was an album I found on CD at the public library when I was 13, 14 years old. I didn't know who Ben Harper was, and I rented this CD. And to be honest, I didn't like the music all that much. It was like very jammy, kind of jam band, post Dave Matthews type music. But then randomly on this album, there's this short little instrumental guitar piece, acoustic guitar piece by Ben Harper called Number 3. And it's incredible. It's such an amazing little instrumental guitar piece. It's not technical at all. But it's so melancholy, heavy, pretty. Yeah, you could show this to like anyone who's into solo guitar music and not tell them who made it, and they would like it. They'd be like, oh, this is awesome. And it's like, yeah, it's just a random Ben Harper song.
All right, so we're going to give a listen to Ben Harper's track, Number 3.
Thank you.
there you go. This track that we just heard, we've played it so often on this show that I don't even think I have to name who it is or the name of the track, but I will. It's the title track, Evening Star, from the famous Frippinino album, Evening Star. I have to say that so many artists that I speak to on this show point to this record for all different reasons. You know, they could be electronic artists, they could be guitar artists, they could be ambient, they could be about anything. Pedal Steel, this is one of Luke Schneider's favorite records of all time. It's just everybody points to this record. It's no surprise that you did the same. But the one thing that surprised me when I listened to it in the context of your playlist and of your own music and your playing is that, wow, I saw some of the Haydn touchstones in this track, some of the cross picking, the use of harmonics, the use of textures, even some of your early slide work. If you had translated that to Ebo, it's like, okay, I get it. You know, there's the DNA right there. And I never put any of those together and until you presented it here.
Yeah, I mean, the Evening Star album, it's funny the influence it had on my playing, because I probably found that at 15 or 16 and found a vinyl copy of it on eBay and bought it back then and listened to it all the time. And it's funny, in my early 20s, when I hadn't really performed live all that much, I would play music that actually doesn't sound like any of my records. I'd play house shows and I would bring an electric guitar, an amp, a loop pedal, and Evo, and I would just make knockoff Frippinino music with that exact same sound. So there was a lot of people in Amarillo who associated me with that sound, because they would see me play house shows just doing that, and then they would hear my records and be like, oh, that's nothing like what I heard you play. So, I mean, I definitely spent a lot of time copying that exact album and sound. I would just play that exact style of music live with an Ebo and a loop pedal. And then once I left that phase and started really focusing on acoustic finger-picking guitar, I kind of found a way to include microscopic references to that record in the production of my albums. So you can definitely hear little specks of it in my music.
Cool. All right. So now we're going to jump into another heavyweight after Robert Fripp. Another person that I always point to in the sort of ambient guitar playing, and that's Ry Cooder. We've already talked about him a couple times here. Kind of unavoidable, this guy. You know, the records that kind of music that you play, that I play, you know, everyone talks about Apollo Atmospheres with Daniel Lanois and Bruce Langhorne's The Hired Hand. And there's just no escaping the soundtrack to Paris, Texas. This sounds like it was another Amarillo library find for you.
Yeah, a lot of the Ry Cooder stuff came through at the library. I mean, and my discovery of Ry Cooder was so interesting because, I mean, I found his music starting with the earlier first four records he did, which a lot of those are just him covering old traditional songs from the 20s, 30s, 40s. And then I found Captain Beefheart's Safe as Milk that Ry Cooder plays on, and that was super inspirational. And then the Paris, Texas soundtrack, that came a little after I discovered Ry Cooder's initial material. So it was surprising to hear him make more ambient music, because for the most part, Ry Cooder does not make ambient-tinged music, really at all. So it's kind of like a strange album in his catalog, but I think it's the closest I can trace his playing in my music now would be that album, because my music doesn't sound much like Ry Cooder's solo albums from the 70s.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, obviously we talk in Sus a lot about Ry Cooder and his soundtrack work. And just recently I watched Paris, Texas again for the 100th time on TV. And it's amazing, you know, he didn't write that much music for, you know, it's a 2.5 hour long movie. And I think he maybe wrote like a half hour's worth of music at the most. It's used so sparingly, but it's just so... I can't even imagine the movie without the music. And he's just a perfect artist to play the right notes at the right times, and the, and Wim Wenders to know that he would bring that to the movie was kind of amazing thing. So it's a little hard for me to, I love the music, but it's hard to separate the music from the movie because they're one of those things that are so tightly bound together.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, it's definitely why it's one of the greatest film scores of all time, is it is kind of hard to listen to it separate from the film. But then again, it's hard to listen to it because it's not on anything. It's been like, I've always wondered why there's some intense copyright issues with that album, because you can't buy it digitally, I don't think. You can't stream it. It can't be uploaded to YouTube. And I've always wondered what the deal was.
And the vinyl of the soundtrack is one of the most highly prized pieces of vinyl that you can get out there. So.
Yeah, which I hate, because I wish more people could hear it. Like younger people, I really wish they could hear that soundtrack, but it's not. Not really easy to get a hold of. Thank you.
we couldn't have a discussion with Hayden about guitar players and not talk about this next guy. I guess he gets brought up in just about every article that I've ever written, ever read about Hayden. He's always mentioned, and we're talking about John Fahey. And the track we just heard was Impressions of Susan from the 1967 album, The Days That Have Gone By, Volume 6. I mentioned this before to Hayden. It seems like about every 10 years or so, there's a John Fahey resurgence, and people start bringing him up and pointing to him. And I would have to say, because of the work that Hayden's done over the last 2 or 3 years, John Fahey's name has been brought up a lot more. So congrats on that.
Well, thank you. I mean, I feel like the idea of Fahey having a resurgence every 10 years is a really great thing, because the funny thing is, I feel like whenever people make statements saying they're like burned out about hearing, like they're tired of hearing about John Fahey, I'm never tired about hearing about John Fahey, because he'll never be overrated. He will never be rated adequately. He will always be underrated. You know, his work for me is so important that there's no way to truly put into words how special it is. And it's like a limitless test for me, where it's like, if someone tells me they don't like John Fahey, it's kind of a tough thing, because it's, when someone says that, it's like, how can I relate to you?
Yeah.
If someone says they don't like Fahey, I'm just at a loss for words, because it's like, if you don't get it, then there's nothing I can do to help you. You know, this is life-changing stuff that will never be replicated. No one will ever be better than him either, ever. There will never be someone better than Fahey. Sorry, Robbie Basho's not even close to Fahey. Not even close. No one's close to Fahey. The best. It's about as good as it gets.
Yeah, and, you know, luckily, because of the continued resurgence in his appreciation, there have been, over the years, a lot of releases and re-releases. So there's a lot of ways to listen to him. It's not like he's hard to find.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. I'm glad to see people discovering his music every day. I hope more people discover it. It's Fahey's music has just been a gift in my life that has just kept on giving years and years and years later. And his music, it's not just like a gift to my life, like, oh, he's brought me a lot of enjoyment. Fahey's the reason I'm doing what I do now. Without John Fahey, I would be sitting in a cubicle working at a bank like I was 10 years ago.
I can't think of a better person to answer this question for me, but what does it mean when people say that he's an American primitive guitar player? What is the definition of American primitive guitar playing? I'm at a loss.
I mean, I think it's been said before that, like, Fahey, he would claim that he didn't come up with that term, even though there's other places that claim Fahey did come up with the term American primitive. But the quick version of the story is that American primitive was referencing the painting movement, which had to do more with just being untaught. But I think there's an element of confusion thinking that it's saying that it's like almost dumb, primitive guitar playing. There's also been some people that have thought it's like, you know, because he was influenced by pre-war blues, that it was somehow saying that pre-war blues like Son House or Charlie Patton was primitive music. When I feel like it's a completely misguided assessment, where the American primitive thing came from just a style of painting, which meant untaught or untrained. But someone who's untaught or untrained can make technically challenging works, be it painting or in music. And Fahey's music in no way was primitive or simple. It actually could be very complex, very emotional, very heavy. But to be honest, he was untaught in terms of he never went and studied at a music conservatory and learned how to write. He wasn't Frank Zappa. He wasn't Zappa learning like Edgar Varese, like reading like scores and writing his own scores. Fahey was an untaught person who found a way to take all of his influences and make a new thing. I think Fahey's closest contemporary in his approach in a lot of ways is there's a lot of people that will say Fahey stole from others to make his own music, which is completely not the true narrative. Fahey had more in common with the rap producer Madlib. The way Madlib, he collects records and he pulls from them and makes these incredibly heavy, psychedelic, multi-layered beats. I've never listened to Madlib and thought, wow, Madlib's ripping off this person. Madlib makes Madlib music. Mm-hmm. Madlib pulls from so many things where The other day, I was talking to a friend about a totally different musical artist who I respect. And I was talking about the difference between this artist and another artist. And I said, this artist is incredibly good at sounding like his influences. I said, but this artist is incredibly good at making his influences sound like him. And I feel like that's the thing with Fahey, is he could take any influence, like be it Charlie Patton, Hank Williams, avant-garde classical music. He could take all of those things and make them sound like himself. And to me, that's not stealing. It's the same exact thing Madlib did, where he pulls from so many sources to make his own world from it. You know, John Fahey was not like Stephen Grossman being like a perfect pre-war blues historian player. I don't think Fahey had an interest in being a player like that. I think Fahey had an immense respect for that kind of music, but I don't think his objective was ever being a historian player. I think he was always tearing things down and building up beautiful new worlds with those sources.
Well, thank you for a beautiful answer. That's more than I could find other places. One of the questions I had, and you just brought up, were you self-taught?
Yes and no. When I was 13, I took guitar lessons that were like, learn to play a G chord, C chord, D, like very simple kind of regular guitar lessons. But I quit after a year or two once I knew how to, I guess, play guitar. But I didn't know how to finger pick. I didn't know how to play slide. None of the way I play guitar now comes from anything, really, from my guitar lessons. The stuff I learned how to play was all from listening to Fahey albums, Cocky, Rycooter, listening to CDs. So yes and no. I got lessons when I was younger, but I was self-taught when it came to how I actually play guitar now.
That's what I figured. All right, so the Giants just keep coming. We're gonna talk about another one now, and we already talked about him earlier in the podcast, Leo Kottke. I have to say that Leo Kottke's 1973 album, My Feet Are Smiling, I think that did as much for his career as it did for the overall sales of 12-string guitars. I think I heard more college kids abuse a 12-string guitar back in the 70s because of this album than just about anything else. I mean, everyone thought, oh my God, Leo Kottke, you know, they ditched their 6-string, bought a 12-string, and then just banged on it for a while, thinking that they could do what Kottke did. And then in the end, most of those out-of-tune 12-strings just sat in a corner for the rest of their life. So.
Yeah, Leo Kottke to me is an interesting player because he's another ground zero player for me in terms of like a Rycooter. Because Leo Kottke for me, I discovered before Fahey. And the way I discovered Kottke and Fahey was my parents had a TV cabinet in the living room. And in the cabinet below the TV was like a bunch of my parents' CDs. And we're talking things like Bee Gees' Greatest Hits, James Taylor, like things like that, things I wasn't interested in. But in there was the best of Leo Kottke on a CD, and I didn't know who Leo Kottke was. And I was probably 14 when I found that CD under there and started listening to it a lot. And I asked my mom about it, and she was like, oh, I got it from my dad, my grandfather, as a birthday gift, but he never really listened to it. And when my grandfather passed away, I think my mom got the CD back somehow. And then I found it as a 14-year-old, started listening to the music a lot, and then the liner notes, the liner notes mentioned John Fahey, who I had never heard of. So I discovered John Fahey through the liner notes of the Leo Kottke CD. That's literally how I found Fahey, was it talked about Fahey in the liner notes. But Kottke's interesting because the song I selected that you're going to play is, that's the song that taught me how to finger pick in terms of doing the rotating, revolving bass line, the back and forth bass line. I did the double thumb thing. I didn't know how to do that, and I couldn't figure out how to do that. And then this song, I was listening to it over and over and over, and I'm pretty sure I learned how to pick it with my guitar on my lap, almost like a lap steel. But that's when I finally understood the double thumb thing. I just kept doing it, and finally it just clicked, like snap. I was like, oh, that's how you do the double thumb thing. So that's where that came from, was all this one Leo Kottke song.
Cool. And that song is, we're going to hear here in a minute, The Spanish Entomologist from the 1995 album Greenhouse. Let's give it a play. That was Steve Hackett from Genesis playing Horizons. And sorry, folks, if you thought that Hayden and I had gotten our yah-yahs out about Genesis earlier in the podcast, that's just not true. We had we got another Genesis track here, or another Genesis guitarist anyway. There'd be no one that I would want to ask more than you, Hayden. We talked about Anthony Phillips. Now let's talk about Steve Hackett.
Yeah, and this track is interesting because there's something really weird about this song sitting on the Genesis album Foxtrot, because the idea of all these grand prog epics with mellotrons and all of these instruments, and then just in the middle of the album, there's a solo guitar piece, which feels very much of its era in a way that they would allow just a little instrumental guitar piece to be on there. But I mean, if you look at other prog rock records at the time...
Yes, did that in almost every record. And yeah.
Yeah, they had Clap on the Yes album. Yeah. And then you have Horizons on this album. I mean, I thought it was really cool that they allowed this very bare, just solo acoustic guitar piece to be on this incredible album. But this track's interesting because this track, you can really tell the difference between Anthony Phillips and Steve Hackett. Is Steve Hackett's playing feels very, very, very classical oriented in terms of he played a lot of nylon string classical music, but this song you can really tell his feel is pulling more from very traditional classical music, which Anthony Phillips does too. But Hackett's feels more studied classical, where Anthony Phillips is more pastoral, esoteric, kind of like revolving lines. But this is just such a beautiful guitar piece that continues the tradition of gorgeous acoustic guitar work in Genesis from Anthony Phillips.
Yeah, well, that's great. Well, Hayden, it's been amazing. It's really so great to have you on the show again, and to be able to find that we have even more common ground than I thought we did. It was really amazing. I'm going to mention it. Depending on when you hear this podcast, this episode is going to come out right before Hayden's doing his last promotional show. Yeah, and I'll be performing at this festival as well. It's called the Across the Horizon Festival. It's in LA, and I can't wait to see what you've got next on the horizon. I think you told me that you are heading off to Wyoming for a while to do some writing for your next record. Is that what you're doing?
Yeah, I actually leave in a couple of days. I'm going up to Wyoming for this artist residency through the UCross Foundation. They have this beautiful space out there where I'm going to stay for 2 weeks and finish writing this new studio album I've been working on. Just kind of finishing the writing, getting the songs tight, and then I'm aiming to have the album recorded in June and then have this record done by end of summer. I'm pretty excited about this album. I'm not going to say too much about what this album's going to be because obviously there's going to be instrumental guitar on it. But I'm curious to make this happen and see what people think of it. I'm really excited about this album.
I'm excited about it as well. Well, that's great.
And I also have a live record coming, but
I saw you post a
record.
It's a live record of the taken from some of the shows that you did while you were on tour, right? So
it's taken from only one show. I'm not going to give away too much info on it, but it's from one night. It's a live recording of one night. Just me, no overdubs, completely live, unedited. And it might be the best thing I've ever released, even over my studio albums.
Wow. Well, I'm really, I read that in a post, and I'm hoping and I'm guessing that it has your version of the theme song to Brokeback Mountain, because you do an amazing version of that track.
You'll just have to see if it's on here.
All right, good. All right. Hayden, thanks again. Please keep us posted on all this stuff you're doing. Everyone, don't forget the name of his latest album, The Happiest Times I Ever Ignored, on Mexican Summer Records. If you don't already have it, go out and get it, buy it. I know you've heard me say this before, and I'll continue to say it till I'm blue in the face. Streaming is a great way to discover new music, old music, any kind of music, but do me a favor. Support the artists that you listen to. Buy something from them, whether it's a CD, a vinyl, a t-shirt, a bumper sticker, because streaming does not pay the bills. Do your best to support artists like Hayden and all the artists that he brought on the show today. Hayden, once again, thank you. Thank you so much for taking the time. And I look forward to seeing you at the Across the Horizon Festival.
Thank you, Bob. I'm excited to see you there. It's going to be fun.
Until next time, this is Bob Holmes from Sus. And thanks again for listening to Ambient Country.